Welcome to the Global Research News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman, and my guest this morning is Noam Chomsky. Noam is MIT Institute Professor Emeritus of Linguistics. He's a leading political and social critic of Imperial America for over 40 years. I think most listeners know that. He's also so widely quoted and very well known as an anti-war critic. Noam is an extremely frequent lecturer, world traveler, prolific author beyond my imagination of many, many, many articles, probably in the hundreds, and many dozens of books. I've read my share of them. And Noam, I welcome you very warmly to the program. I believe we're connected. Oh, we're not connected yet. Well, let me go on a little bit. We will talk about the Gaza war again and the aftermath. Oh, wonderful. Noam, are we on together?
Yeah, I think so.
Oh, wonderful. We made it this time. I just introduced you to my listeners, and we got on the air together. I wonder if you remember on my other program we had a couple of aborted attempts.
Oh, really?
No, I don't. You're on with so many, it's hard to remember. But one time a storm knocked out a transmission tower, and we both were waiting to be connected. It never happened. And you gave me the Rumsfeld line, stuff happens.
Well, maybe we'll be lucky this time.
Well, hopefully we'll be lucky today. I've written my share on the Gaza war and aftermath, and you wrote a couple of articles, and you gave a, I guess it was an interview at in your office at MIT. Let me just quote one line from the article you wrote, Exterminate All the Brutes, the Conrad line from Out of Darkness. And you wrote that decades ago, you wrote that those who call themselves supporters of Israel are in reality supporters of its moral degeneration, I'm sorry. Same thing, really. And probable ultimate destruction. Mm-hmm. Let me emphasize that. And probable ultimate destruction. Regrettably, that judgment looks more and more plausible. I couldn't agree more with you, Noam. Maybe you want to say something about that.
Well, an international poll just came out yesterday, Program on International Policy Attitudes, ranking countries of the world as to how they were viewed by others. And Israel is right down at the bottom.
Absolute rock bottom.
It's depending how you calculate, it's roughly like Iran and Pakistan, but by some measures the worst. You can't act in a way which alienates the entire world forever, hoping that the United States will bail you out. That's a very dangerous course to take.
And of course, they've done it for decades and gotten away with it. And I don't know what
the United States has bailed them out.
The U.S. has bailed them out, and politically, economically, militarily, you name it. No, when we hear that music, it means a commercial break is coming on.
Okay.
We have this one, and we have three others, but we've got about 50 minutes or as much time as you can spare.
Good.
Let's take the break, and we'll be right back. We're talking about the Gaza war and aftermath. Noam, I've seen past polls like the one you're citing, and I think they pretty much came out the same way, even when things were so much more in the headlines about Iraq and Afghanistan and so on. In Israel,
I should mention, incidentally, that this poll was taken before the Gaza attack.
Oh, my goodness.
If it was taken now, it would be worse, much worse.
Probably whatever the numbers you saw would be much more emphatically emphasized now.
Yeah, undoubtedly.
The one good thing about the aftermath or the conflict and the aftermath was the really almost incredible worldwide opposition. just outrage in world capitals right around the globe. And I don't remember anything like this to this extent, the way it happened this time.
Well, there was something, you know, there have been worse atrocities, like the invasion of Lebanon in 1982. It killed about 15 to 20,000 people, destroyed southern Lebanon and much of Beirut. Had no pretext whatsoever. It was just an effort to expand into the West Bank, as was conceded, and to block negotiations. And it had protests, but nothing like this one. There was something, you know, there's something particularly savage and cowardly about locking people into a cage so they can't escape, and then smashing them to dust with overwhelming power, you know, against which they have no defense.
And in this case, we're talking about Gaza being a cage, just literally locked in. They can't get in. They can't get out.
Yeah, fishing boats can't go out. Nothing can go. And, I mean, the imagery in the United States and indeed in Europe is that, well, Israel had to defend itself against rockets. But that's just propaganda. I mean, if Israel wanted to defend itself against rockets, it had ways, peaceful ways. One way would have been to accept the ceasefire, which it had never done. You can go into the details if you want. But a deeper way is to stop the crimes being committed in the occupied territories. I mean, the occupied territories are a unit, Gaza and the West Bank. Daily, Israel is carrying out settlement and development projects and breaking up Palestinians areas into unviable cantons in the West Bank. In fact, they accelerated it during the Gaza War when attention was directed elsewhere. Well, you know, that's all criminal. They know it's criminal. They've known it since 1967. And it's undermining any hope for a viable existence for Palestinians. So they have a right to resist it. Well, they can't resist it in the West Bank because of the military controls. Now intensified by the collaborationist army. I mean, the U.S. and Jordan have trained military forces which are being used to suppress dissent and protest in the West Bank. Actually, Obama praised that. He says, wonderful thing. So in the West Bank, you know, they're essentially controlled by force. The last resistance is in Gaza. Well, you know, rockets, in my view, are both criminal and stupid. But you have, but no one has a right to criticize it unless they offer something better. And there is something better. Stop the criminal act.
And in fact, you said yourself the easy way. I think I've seen you say this in articles a number of times. The way to stop people like Hamas or whoever, the Iraqi resistance, the Afghan resistance, the way to get them to stop attacking you is stop attacking them.
Yeah, and in fact, you know, we know that. I mean, take our own history. And the colonists, the rebels, back in the 1770s, I mean, they were terrorists. They were carrying out serious acts of terror. In fact, a huge percentage of the population fled after the British left because of fear of the terror of the rebels. Well, did that mean that the British had a right to respond by violence? No. They could respond by leaving. Okay? End of terror. The same thing just happened in Northern Ireland. It's kind of ironic that George Mitchell, who was appointed to as Obama's emissary to the Middle East, his great achievement was negotiating the a peaceful settlement in Northern Ireland. Now, the IRA carried out very serious terrorist acts. Did the British have a right to respond by violence? No, because they could have responded, and finally did, by addressing the grievances from which the terror arose. And as they did, that's part of Mitchell's mission, the terror dropped, in fact, stopped.
And that was really the success in Northern Ireland, the idea that the British government decided they would stop their violent acts, and the IRA stopped their own violent acts. And the problem in Israel Palestine is it's not happening that way. Washington and Israel both want violence, not peace.
They want peace on their terms.
On their terms, right.
And I should add that in Northern Ireland, it was not just stopping the violence on both sides, but also addressing the grievances. There were real grievances in the Catholic community. And they were to some extent addressed, okay? That undercuts the roots of the violent resistance. And the same would be true in this case, the same would be true in Afghanistan, the same would be true. It's consistent. The same's true in our own history, as I mentioned. You know, not all of these cases are identical. You know, no analogies are perfect. Otherwise, they wouldn't be analogies. They'd be identities. But the basic point is pretty common.
I think sooner or later, an occupied people get very edgy. They don't take kindly to occupations, especially when they can be very oppressive. Israel's occupation has been extremely oppressive and nasty, and our occupations of Afghanistan and Iraq, the same thing. And sooner or later, push comes to shove, and people won't take this anymore.
Yeah, just as the oppression of the British and in our history was, you know, it was there, but it wasn't anywhere near as oppressive as the examples you've mentioned. Nevertheless, there was a rebellion which founded the United States.
And those were our great heroes, but when people resist, as they have a right to do, according to international law, whether it's in Gaza, wherever it is, we give them the notorious label. No, we call them terrorists. And one of them happens to be a Democratic.
If they're working for us, we call them freedom fighters.
So
the the fanatic Islamic extremists who Reagan helped bring to Afghanistan, they were called freedom fighters, or the Contras.
Yeah, I remember it so, Contras as well.
Yeah. I mean, they were brutal, murderous terrorists, but we were funding and supporting and training them, so okay, they're freedom fighters. It's a very clear criterion. Our terrorists are freedom fighters.
I think my listeners know very well, in this case, as far as Hamas goes, and they're on the State Department's list as a terrorist organization. They happen to be a democratically elected government, probably the most democratic in the Middle East. I guess Lebanon, you could say, was a democratic, as a democratic government, but not so much as Hamas was.
No, in fact, well, Lebanon, you know, is maybe the closest thing to a democracy in the Arab world, but it has a sectarian government. So the president has to be a Maronite, and the Speaker of the House has to be a Sunni, and so it goes, Shiite, and so it goes, you know. But, so yes, it's partially democratic. But Hamas was elected in a free election. In fact, it was internationally monitored, was recognized to be free and uncoerced. Actually, the only coercion in the election was from the United States and Israel, which worked very hard to try to prop up their own candidate, Mahmoud Abbas, by pouring in money for public works and all sorts of things to try to build up his image. Nevertheless, the population voted freely and elected Hamas, not just it's a vote in the Gaza and the West Bank, in fact. Well, the United States and Israel instantly turn to punishing the population harshly for voting the wrong way. And to their disgrace, Europe sort of backed them. We just can't tolerate democratic elections unless they come out the way we say they must. There's plenty of cases of this, but this is a particularly dramatic one.
Well, your friend Ed Herman wrote a book called Demonstration Elections, where we managed to arrange everything about it, including the media reports, to assure that we got the government that we wanted. And, oh, it's an old book written maybe 25 years ago or so.
Yeah.
It's a very sad situation. Yeah, from January 2006, when Hamas was elected, over 3 years now, just a total clampdown, a boycott, isolation. And then
Israel even went to the extent of cutting off the flow of water. the United States blocked aid that they thought might go to nurses and teachers. You know? I mean, it was very harsh. And it was straight punishment of the population for voting the wrong way. And what made it particularly striking was at the very same time, commentators here and the political leaders, George Bush and so on, are hailing our love of democracy and our struggle to promote democracy all over the world and so on, completely unable to see or unwilling to let themselves see that dramatically, in this case, but in many other cases, we're crushing democracy unless it comes out the way we want. Actually, there is interesting scholarly work on this.
No, I'm going to interrupt you because they'll break away. Let's take this break and we'll come right back, and then you can pick up on that point.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm on with Noam Chomsky. Noam, please continue where we broke away.
Yeah, I was talking about the scholarly work on what's called democracy promotion. It's that's kind of a mantra in American discourse, pretty much across the spectrum, that the United States is deeply committed to democracy promotion. Reagan was the apostle of democracy promotion. George Bush was orating about the need for democracy and so on. There is actually scholarly work on it, and it's interesting. The best work is by, and the most highly regarded in scholarship, is by Thomas Carruthers, who was regards himself as a neo-Reaganite. He was the director of the Law and Democracy Program of the Carnegie Foundation, and he was actually in Reagan's State Department working on democracy promotion. So he writes from the point of view of a scholar and also an insider, and he runs through the record. And he finds the record, for him, very puzzling. The record shows, as he puts it, that the United States supports democracy if and only if it conforms to strategic and economic interests. Well, you know, he could have said the same thing about Stalin. So, yes, what that means, of course, is democracy promotion is just not a concern. What is a concern is strategic and economic interests. And if democracy happens to support them, at least some kind of formal democracy, okay, we love it. If it opposes them, we smash it. And that's quite consistent. So it goes through the Reagan years, goes right up to the present. And he regards it as a kind of a puzzle. What he says is American leaders are schizophrenic. But, you know, that's not the interpretation. The American dominant policy-making classes understand what they're doing. They're concerned with strategic and economic interests. And if you can cover it up with elections, fine. If elections happen or other democratic efforts happen to undermine it, well, we're against it. And that's true constantly. I mean, the Palestinian case is a dramatic one, but it's by no means the only one. I mean, take, say, Bolivia. Bolivia is regarded as a country where democracy is under threat. So it's ranked as one of the countries where democracy isn't working. Now, why isn't it working? Well, because it's the most effective democracy in the Western Hemisphere, and far more than us. I mean, in 2005, Bolivia had an election of a kind we can't even dream about, nor can Europe. I mean, the mass of the population participated. The majority is the indigenous population, the majority, which is the most repressed population in the hemisphere, entered the political arena and elected someone from their own ranks, not someone who gives them instructions on how to push forward Grand Obama. On the contrary, they formed the policies, and they elected a poor peasant from their own ranks to carry out those policies. And they're critical ones, not hope and change, but control over resources, cultural rights, problems of justice and so on. And furthermore, the election was just one stage in an ongoing popular struggle. It's not just, okay, we push a button once every 4 years and then we go home. No, this is one thing you do in the course of constant efforts to direct and run and control your own society. Well, you know, that's lively, vibrant, functioning democracy. So therefore, it's called opposition to democracy. And in fact, the U.S., not surprisingly, is supporting a quasi-secessionist movement of the old elites, the Europeanized, mostly white, wealthy old elites, who, of course, can't stand the idea that the country is becoming democratic. So the U.S. is naturally supporting them, including their violence. And the media are supporting them. In fact, you know, this striking examples of the depth of the fear of democracy right in this case. So,
indeed, Noman, you know that Bolivia just affirmed a new constitution.
That's right.
And, I mean, it's got a lot of good stuff in it. It's far from perfect. Doesn't do much to the big landowners. What they have, they can keep. They're just restricted on how much more they can buy. But Bolivia is one example. My favorite example in South America is Venezuela, and I've written a fair amount on Venezuela. They have a big referendum coming up a week from this Sunday, and. I guess in one sense it's controversial to let all politicians run for re-election as often as they wish, but on the other hand, it gives the people the right to decide who they want to represent them. Well, I guess that's what democracy is.
Well, that was U.S. policy up until the 1940s. Most of U.S. history, sure, you could run as often as you wanted. FDR won 4 elections. So,
and we think of him as maybe our best.
Yeah. I mean, maybe it's right, maybe it's wrong, but the point is, it's question is what they want. And incidentally, when a tiny majority voted it down a referendum last time, it was accepted by the government. It's striking that there are studies, regular polling studies by a very respected Chilean polling organization, Latino Barometro, which measures popular attitudes throughout the Latin America on all sorts of things. Among their questions they ask is support for democracy, support for the government, support for the government's policies, hope for the future, and so on. Since the Chavez years, Venezuela's ranked right at the top.
No, we have to break. We have to break again. Let's do it. We'll come right back.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network, because you can handle the truth.
Welcome back. I'm on with Noam Chomsky. Noam, let me mention one thing, and then you continue where you left off. During the break, I'm on Lynn Stewart's distribution list, and I just got an email. I didn't know this. I didn't know today was an anniversary. She wants people at noon today, when we get off the air, to call the White House comment line, and I've got a phone number. I'll give it to listeners. Today is the 33rd anniversary of the imprisonment of political prisoner Leonard Peltier. 33 years today in prison. Something he never did. And the phone number is 202-456-1111. 202-456-1111. I assure listeners I will be calling. This is what we do here, Noam, but any comments on that? But where you left off.
Right. I didn't know it was the anniversary either, but yes, that's a critically important case and a real very severe miscarriage of justice, so I hope there will be pressures.
To call to ask for executive clemency for this guy who's been in prison, not doing easy time, doing hard time for 33 years.
Yeah.
And he's not the only one. There are a lot of others there besides him. It's another one of my core topics, known political prisoners. Lynn has been on my program a couple of times, and she's got an appeal pending that could literally come down any time now.
And, yeah, that's another very important case.
Oh, it's a very, very important case when they go after the lawyers. Lynn, a very courageous human rights lawyer. And as soon as that verdict comes down, I'll get her back on this program. We'll talk about it.
Part
so,
of
fingers crossed, holding our breath.
Yeah. It's so, part of a very serious attack on civil liberties, especially under the Bush administration, but it goes deeper than that.
Oh, it certainly does.
That's what the case shows.
I'm very worried about the Obama administration. I wrote an article called, I wrote a few articles on all of his main appointees, but the one on his so-called national security team, I called it Obama's war cabinet.
That's quite right.
I don't see any peaceful intentions there. I see militarism, belligerency, continuation of foreign wars, occupation.
Well, I don't usually agree with Condoleezza Rice, but, she had an article in which she said that the Obama foreign policy programs will be a continuation of the second Bush administration, which was quite different from the first Bush administration. And she's probably right. You know, there's all indications that that's going to be true on Israel-Palestine, which is one of the worst, on Afghanistan, where he wants to make it worse than Bush, more militaristic, less effort to pursue the peaceful options that do exist, but they're just disregarded and so on.
And this was the guy who promised us change. Change we can believe in. I guess rhetoric we cannot believe in. All rhetoric, no follow through. But it didn't surprise me. To know where Obama stood, no more, all you had to do was listen to what he was saying during the campaign.
Or read his webpage. I wrote about it a year ago, just looking at his webpage. That was pretty clear.
Also check his voting record, which I wrote about some months back, and you see the stuff that he supported, and people don't do that. So you get people, including intelligent people, thinking that we really had hopeful change in this man. And the celebration that took place in my home city, I live in Chicago, and what a massive celebration there was the night he was declared president.
Well, I think part of that celebration was goodbye Bush, you know. But, in fact, it was pretty clear in Washington. But, yes, he did succeed in making people feel that something significant was going to happen. Actually, the advertising industry, which runs the campaigns, it gives an award every year for the best marketing campaign of the year. And 2008, they just gave their award to Obama. They said he ran the best marketing campaign of 2008. He beat out Apple. But we know what marketing campaigns are. They're not supposed to tell you the truth about anything. You look at an ad on television, you don't expect to find the truth about the product that's being advertised. You expect to find illusion, mystification, you know, appeal to emotions, something like that, but not the facts. And the same is true when the same institutions run political campaigns. And they're very frank about it. So top executives in the public relations industry said that the Obama marketing model will be picked up by CEOs all over the place because we're so effective. In fact, one of them said, we've been marketing candidates ever since the Reagan years, like commodities, and this is our greatest triumph. Well, okay. If people want to be deluded by ads on television, it's their choice. And if they want to be deluded by marketing of candidates like commodities, it's a choice too. But a reasonable person will be pretty careful.
Well, it's the reason for programs like this, Noam, an antidote to what you get through the major media. And it's and of course during the campaign season it just goes nonstop around the clock.
Yeah.
And
These are electoral extravaganzas, and it's quite striking to compare them with a functioning democracy, like say Bolivia, the poorest country in South America. I mean, I don't think any commentator can point this out or even perceive it, but the campaigns are going on more or less the same time. One of them is almost completely dysfunctional, ours. The other is one of the best, maybe the best example of functioning democracy in the world. But that one is condemned as anti-democratic, and ours is hailed as the model of democracy. Well, that tells us something about our own culture, our own understanding. We've kind of lost the sense of what democracy is. Democracy is not a system in which you get organized to push Brand Obama and then you wait for instructions from the leader. It's a system in which the population develops programs and policies and picks representatives to carry out their policies. Okay, that's pretty much what happened in Bolivia. Virtually the opposite happened here.
And it seems to be true each time, even locally, president's going to run for two terms so far, although there was a lot of fear that maybe Bush would try to stage some kind of a coup d'etat and stay in office. It didn't happen. I couldn't imagine it would happen. He was so unpopular. In fact, I thought it was a stroke of genius that this was the perfect moment in our history, Noam, to put a black face in the Oval Office. But he's really no different than any of the others. But it's extraordinary that we would do that at this time.
Well, he's different than Bush, but almost any candidate would have been. I mean, the Bush administration was, you know, it's a pretty narrow political spectrum that we have, but it is a spectrum. And the Bush administration was way off at the extremist end. So almost anybody who came in, including McCain, would have been very likely to push back towards the center. And that's pretty much what Obama did. I don't think he shouldn't have misled anyone. He didn't indicate, except by rhetoric, meaningless rhetoric, that it was going to be any different than that. If you looked at his policies, you know, that's pretty much what they were. Can't really criticize him, but if you look through the appointments, that's just what it is. I mean, take the economic stimulus. That's the economic problem, the financial crisis. I mean, that's the immediate huge crisis facing the country. Well, who did he select to deal with it? The people who created it. His top advisors were Robert Rubin and Lawrence Summers, Clinton's secretaries of the Treasury. Who helped lay the basis for the crisis? I mean, Rubin was in the lead in undermining the New Deal legislation, Glass-Steagall Act, that protected commercial banks from risky investments. As soon as he got that rescinded, he left the Treasury, left the government, and became a director of Citigroup, which used the new legislation to buy up, pick up all kind of, and hold on to all kind of risky investments. End result is crashed. Now the government's pouring tens of billion dollars into trying to rescue it from his decisions and the decisions of others like him. And incidentally, Citigroup is now kind of trying to turn back to a bank that would be protected somehow get rid of the risky investments that got them into the trouble. In other words, to the situation before the repeal of Glass-Steagall. And, of course, they expect to be bailed out by the government, which they are. The taxpayer bails them out. It's not the first time it's happened. It happened in the Reagan years, too. He was replaced by Lawrence Summers. Summers was in the lead in undermining congressional efforts to regulate exotic financial instruments, derivatives, credit swap default, and so on and so forth. Well, okay, he succeeded. They wouldn't regulate them. It's another major element of the crash. Nobody knows who owes what to whom. You can't figure out what the toxic assets are. It went totally haywire. All right, these two guys are picked as the first two top economic advisors. Summers is his protege. Timothy Geithner is now Secretary of Treasury. And if you go down the list, it's pretty much the same. In fact, the business press, Bloomberg News, had an interesting article on the meeting of Obama's a couple of dozen economic advisors and went through their records one by one and concluded that these people shouldn't be invited to run the economy, and half of them should be getting subpoenas for devious financial chicanery and fixing books and so on and so forth. I mean, there are other economists, who have a more progressive slant, but they were excluded.
I've had them on this program. I've had honest, very astute economists on this program talking about the economic crisis. And it certainly is a different point of view than you get through the major media. We literally put the people who caused this thing, and you've got to throw in a monumental amount of fraud because they knew they were packaging a bunch of junk. And they disguised it. It was like putting a legitimate frosting on a toxic cake and not telling anybody what's beneath the frosting. And to get sovereign governments and sophisticated investors to buy this stuff, like funds invested in Bernie Madoff. But I think Madoff was pocket change compared to the massive fraud. A guy like Bill Gross, the biggest bond fund manager in the world, he refers to the U.S. economy, because of all this, as a Ponzi economy.
Yeah.
Now, this guy says it. This guy is supposed to stand up for the economy. But I quoted him in one of my articles saying that. And it's true. And now we have possibly the greatest economic mess we've ever faced. And nobody knows how to get out of this thing. Nothing has worked so far.
Well, partly what's been done so far, the first half of the bailout, the Paulson bailout, was just to give money to the banks without any strings attached. It was clear what was going to happen. I mean, Joseph Stiglitz, Nobel laureate, when this was announced, his quote in the Wall Street Journal is saying, look, if you give money to the banks, without any conditions, they'll put it into their own pockets. I mean, they're not going to use it for what you want, lending. They'll use it for what they want, rebuilding their capital, mergers and acquisitions, maybe making loans to federally guaranteed borrowers, but not for what you want. And, yeah, that's exactly what happened.
And paying themselves big salaries and bonuses besides.
Yeah, but, I mean, that's natural. I mean, they could have read that in Adam Smith. So sure, if you just give money to the rich, they'll use it for their own purposes, naturally. The second part of the bailout is supposed to have some conditions attached, but we'll hear more about that next week.
I don't believe them, like restrictions on corporate salaries or whatever. I, honest to God, don't believe them. I think there'll be loopholes. You can drive a Rolls Royce through Nome.
Yeah. First of all, that was a good political move. I mean, there's so much anger in the country about these guys spending millions of dollars to fix up their offices and so on, while getting huge bonuses while the country's crashing. So yes, it was a good political move to say we'll put a cap on executive compensation for the companies that get big bailouts, but the way it's set up, it's going to apply to very few companies, maybe none, but certainly very few. And the counter argument is, well, we have to let the market determine what executive compensation should be, but the market doesn't determine it. I mean, the way the government regulations are set up, the chief executive picks the board that will set his salary. Okay, what do you think is going to happen? You know, I mean, it's not quantum mechanics. You know.
And he in turn sits on other boards where he gets to decide what those CEOs will make.
So of course this is what happens. It certainly has nothing to do with competence. I mean, the people who are getting rewarded are, you know, I mean, if they were carpenters, they'd be put out of business. You know, they've shown radical incompetence.
Well, I've said on this program that most of my working life I was part of a small family business, a very cyclical business, certainly nothing like the big guys in the way we ran things. But we went right to the edge of the abyss a few times, and once especially I remember we really thought we were just about set to wrap things up. It was too late. There was no way to save ourselves. We never got 10 cents in bailouts from the government.
No, in fact, there is a principle called too big to fail. It's not a law, but it's an understood principle. If you're big enough, the government isn't going to let you fail. Well, that's an insurance policy. And the big, like Bank of America and Citigroup and so on, they have that insurance policy that encourages them to take risky steps, okay, for obvious reasons. If you're going to be bailed out by the government, why not take risky steps? Maybe you'll make money. It also gives them a competitive advantage over others who don't have that insurance policy. So the system is kind of designed to reward failure. Well, I'm sorry, I've got to get off. I've got another interview.
You've got another appointment. Yeah. Oh, my goodness. Well, it certainly was an honor to have you on the Gnome. Can I mention one thing before you go?
Yeah.
I check the International Middle East Media Center every day. Mm-hmm. And one of its stories, a very brief story today, is a bill has been introduced in Congress criticizing the UN Relief and Works Agency in Gaza for supporting a terrorist organization. Imagine that.
Incredible.
It'll be one of these non-binding resolutions, I imagine, but pretty outrageous stuff. No, I appreciate you coming on. It was terrific finally getting on air with you. And I'll let you run off to your appointment. I'll finish up. Welcome back to the News Hour. I'll finish up on my own. It was exciting for me to have Noam Chomsky on. He has been a distinguished analyst and scholar and professor at MIT for so many years, and he's about 80 years old now, but he keeps going strong, and he's at this every day, lecturing, giving talks, and still writing, and I think he's published about 100 books. I can't imagine anybody writing that many. His main field is linguistics. He's pretty world renowned in that field, and I've never read any of those. I've read his political books. Let me mention that I've stressed what's going on in Gaza and occupied Palestine so much on this program. Not just because it's so important to me, it's a personal issue for me, but it goes way, way beyond that. I've had people agree with me. I feel very strongly about this, that there's no possibility of peace in the Middle East unless there's an equitable settlement to that conflict, and there isn't a hint of it in sight. And in recent decades, Democrats have been more subservient to the Israeli issue than Republican administrations. I think Bush broke that mold a little bit because I don't think any administration ever was so supportive of Israel as the Bush administration. But Jim Petras, who's been on this program several times, and he'll be back after mid-February, and we'll discuss it again. He wrote an important article called The First Jewish President, referring to Barack Obama. And, I believe it. Obama, all you'd have to do is read what he said. Read the quotes, the people in his cabinet, the officials, the Middle East envoys, the people around him. He's totally supportive of Israel. And he just ignored, again, Hamas is a terrorist group as far as he's concerned. The idea of a democratically elected doesn't even get mentioned. And George Mitchell, the so-called envoy to Israel-Palestine, guy well-known, former Democrat majority leader in the Senate, and he went over, he spoke to the Israeli leaders, he spoke to Mubarak of Egypt, and he talked to Mahmoud Abbas, the Fatah leader in the West Bank. His government, Fatah, I call a coup d'etat government. He runs the West Bank, and the legitimate government, Hamas, runs Gaza. So the illegitimate government is the one that we deal with, and the legitimate one we call a terrorist organization. That's no way to do business, and it's no way to achieve a peaceful resolution. Well, occupied Palestine is one issue. It's gone on since 1967. I meant to ask Noam to explain the so-called Alone Plan that goes back to the year 1967. The current Prime Minister, Ehud Olmert, has what he calls a convergence plan, pretty much the same thing. that they'll basically take any Palestinian land they want. They will continue to colonize, occupy Palestine, taking all the choice areas, at most leaving scrub areas, isolated Bantustans that South Africans who lived under apartheid call what's going on in occupied Palestine far worse, far, far worse than anything black people ever went through in South Africa. We'll pick this up again. We're at the end of our time, and I thank you for joining us. Come back next Monday. We will have, again, a wonderful guest next week. We have four live programs. One will be an archive repeat. Very distinguished guest. I'm grateful for your support. Come back and join us then.